Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Masterclass. Tonight, February 23rd, 2023. Hey, it's 2/23 on 2023. That'll never happen again. Yeah, it just hit me. Cool. We have a great group of people that are going to be presenting this evening. A lot of fun stuff to listen to and learn about. Let's see. And I get to stay for the whole thing. I don't have to leave in between terms. It's always helpful for me. Okay, so we've got Maurice Lospinoso, Christy Simpson, Melanie Basso, Eric Gilbert, and Carla Rodriguez. Sorry, that's just my illness. So Maurice, are you ready to start?
Sure, yeah, I can start it off.
All right, go right ahead and take over the sharing and you'll be good to go.
Okay. Can everybody see my presentation?
Yes, I do.
Interesting. I don't. let me stop sharing. Try it again. There we go. All right, well, good evening, everyone. I'm Maurice. Today we'll be discussing a topic that, in my opinion, is one of the most important yet overlooked areas of IT, enterprise storage. So just a bit about myself before we get started. I've worked in the storage industry for over a decade. I currently work as a technical architect supporting various US government agencies. So I've worked with the Department of Defense, the VA, NASA, Department of Energy, and let's get right into it. So why are we talking about storage? Well, because data is a big deal. We are living in the zettabyte era. If you've never heard of zettabyte before, today it's estimated that there are over 8 zettabytes of data in the world. To add some context to just how large that is, in 2018, the U.S. Library of Congress stored 16 petabytes of data, which amounted to all written literature, and that equaled 0.00016 zettabytes. Or another way to look at it is 8 zettabytes can store roughly 2 trillion DVDs. So there's a lot of data out there, and how's it being used? So for organizations, data is one of the most important valuable assets in today's world. You know, organizations rely on data to make informed decisions. You know, access to accurate, relevant, and timely data allows businesses to identify trends, opportunities, and potential risks. Businesses also need to provide a personalized and seamless customer experience. Data is used to track customer behavior and preferences, enabling business to tailor their products and services to meet customer needs. For example, think of how Amazon, Facebook, and Google use data to target ads and services to you. Next, data is used to optimize business processes, improve operational efficiency, and reduce costs. Lastly, in many industries, data is a key factor in remaining competitive. Organizations that are able to leverage data effectively can gain a competitive advantage by making better decisions, improving their customer experience and operations, and operating more efficiently. So the question is, how is all this data stored in a resilient, robust, and reliable way? The answer is enterprise storage. So what is enterprise storage? It refers to the centralized storage of large amounts of data, like customer information, financial records, product data, and employee records. They typically use specialized hardware, such as high-capacity hard drives that can store, I think, up now to 30 terabyte drives, might be even higher, or solid-state drives, as well as advanced software to manage data storage and access. These systems often offer features such as redundancy, data protection, and high availability to ensure that data is always accessible and protected from data loss. Now imagine what would happen if the hard drive on your computer crashed. Is all your data backed up? You know, how much time would you spend restoring the system? You know, enterprise storage systems are built with multiple layers of redundancy and reliability to ensure failures like that do not cause system outages. Storage systems also need to scale to accommodate new workloads. This can mean adding more hard drives or nodes, you know, to increase capacity or performance. And they also help businesses meet regulatory compliance requirements like GDPR for the EU, HIPAA, PCI DSS, and FISMA. So storage, enterprise storage systems are broken down into different types of workloads they support. This includes network attached storage, NAS, storage area networks, and object storage. You know, the choice of storage system depends on the specific needs of the organization and the type of data being stored. Let's just take a look at what some of those terms mean. The first one is network attached to storage, or NAS. It enables multiple client devices and users to access data from a central pool of disk storage. It's accessible by its own IP address and connected on a LAN over an Ethernet cable, as you can see in the picture. So it runs on the same user network that servers and clients run on. NAS is comparatively inexpensive, and it's commonly used in small to medium-sized businesses where cost is a concern. It supports file protocols like SMB or SIFS for Windows clients. And for Linux clients, you're familiar with NFS, and also things like FTP. So NAS is a really popular place to store items like user files. That could be documents, presentations, spreadsheets, images. You can also store media files like audio and video recordings. You can even have virtual machines stored on NAS, and backup and recovery data, and IoT data also. So you've probably used NAS storage if you've worked in the business world. Some of those examples would include, you know, a shared drive like a P drive or a Q drive or an E drive, or on Linux, like I mentioned earlier, NFS mount points. And next up is storage area networks, or SAN. So it's a highly performance network dedicated to storage that is independent of an organization's common user network. So think of it, it does not generally ride on Ethernet switches. SAN can support a wide range of applications, including those with high I/O and bandwidth requirements like databases, Oracle, and SQL, and virtual machines. They rely on block protocols like Fibre Channel, iSCSI, or Fibre Channel over Ethernet, FCOE, to serve data. And they use block-level access, which allows for more efficient data transfer and management. One of the drawbacks, however, is due to its complexity and cost of implementation, SAN storage may not be the best option for small businesses or organizations with limited budgets and IT resources. They require specialized SAN networking switches, host bus adapters, which are like NICs, to be installed on all servers and storage systems, so it can get pretty pricey. And an example of that would be on a Windows system. They're connected via a logical unit number or a LUN, and they would appear as a like another physically connected hard drive on that system. And just sort of a recap between the two, NAS, you know, and SAN are used for different storage requirements and applications. NAS are well suited for storing and sharing files, while SAN systems are well suited for storing and managing data, such as databases and virtual machines. NAS is slower and cheaper, while SAN is more expensive and much faster. And then the third one that I want to discuss is, lastly, is object storage. So object storage is like a giant warehouse that stores objects instead of boxes. Each object is assigned a unique identifier, just like each box has a label or number that identifies its contents and location. Object storage systems use a flat address space, which means that every object can be accessed directly without the need for traditional file hierarchy. So you don't have to go, you know, C drive, program files, you know, desktop. It's all in a flat hierarchy. So it's like being able to find a box in a warehouse by searching for its label or number rather than having to navigate through, you know, a series of shelves and folders. It's designed to be highly scalable and can easily accommodate large amounts of data, making it ideal for big data and cloud applications. And it's often used for storing unstructured data like documents, images, and video files. And a really common example of object storage is the popular and most widely adopted cloud service, AWS S3, which most of us are probably familiar with. So I could spend the entire hour discussing all the nuances of storage, but we've got a lot of presenters tonight. But here's some additional considerations when discussing storage. So there's been a shift from hard drive HDDs to SSDs in the last few years. Yeah, so HDDs use magnetic disks. Solid state drives use flash memory. SSDs are exponentially more performant and expensive compared to hard drives. And you know, many organizations have already made that switch to SSD-based storage systems for critical workloads. The next one is NVMe. It's a new storage access and transport protocol used for flash and next generation SSDs. It delivers really fast throughput and responses. It's extremely expensive and currently only used on the most critical workloads that require like extreme low latency and high bandwidth. And I mentioned a little bit earlier with cloud storage, but it consists of, storage capacity that is available from a cloud provider like Azure or GCP or AWS. You know, and some of the advantages of cloud storage compared to something physically in your data center are the accessibility, scalability, ease of use, and disaster recovery. With cloud, you can spin up and spin down storage surfaces based on requirements. And an example of that would be like in AWS, you can use S3 for object storage, EBS for SAN, and EFS for NAS storage. Containerized storage includes items like, you know, storage for Kubernetes or software-defined storage, and things like OpenStack. And finally, hyperconverged solutions like Nutanix, Cisco HyperFlex, VMware, and EMC VxRail, they all integrate storage, compute, and sometimes networking into a single unit. So consumers can kind of easily scale by adding new nodes into the infrastructure, and it would increase the storage and compute resources. So I just wanted to include this slide. On the left is a list of the world's biggest storage companies. Many of the names are probably familiar. You know, for example, AWS, it leads the cloud storage offering. And One thing to remember is they all kind of provide similar hardware and software-based solutions to meet the requirements. You know, storage vendors all provide, like I said earlier, the scalability, high availability, security controls, performance, and data protection. On the right side of the screen is Gartner's Magic Quadrant for primary storage. The Magic Quadrant is divided into four quadrants. So in the top right are the leaders. These are vendors that are considered the best in the market. The top left are challengers. These are not quite there. They might be lacking, you know, a vision. The bottom right are the visionaries, and then the bottom left are the niche. So as a vendor, you really want to be in the leaders quadrant, so the top right. It just gives you a list of an idea of who some of them are. And so, you know, storage is a big business and a driving force behind all modern innovations like AI and big data. On average, organizations expect their storage footprint to grow by 40% annually. It's estimated that the storage market will reach about $120 billion by 2026. It's $80 billion right now. And that's it for me. Thank you, everyone. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me via email or Teams chat. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Excellent job. That was really good. Would you consider using a NAS configuration for like a small mom and pop that had like three computers?
Yeah, sure. So they sell off-the-shelf NAS devices now for purposes like that. You know, the companies I listed are really for medium-sized, where you're spending tens or hundreds of thousands for those types of systems. But if you have three, yeah, you can buy like a Western Digital NAS off the shelf for a pretty inexpensive price.
Nice. Okay. Anybody else have any questions?
All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you. Great job, Maurice. Christy, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Go.
Okay. So okay. I recorded most of my presentation, and then I'll take over in real time when I get to a certain point in the presentation. But if you have any questions, let me know, because I'll be advancing it. So let me just bring my screen up. Okay. And oh, helps if I hit the right buttons. And just let me know if you can't hear it or see it. So we'll get started.
Welcome to my presentation on the CISSP certification.
And can everybody hear it?
Yes.
Okay.
The CISSP is a Certified Information System Security Professional Certificate, and it was created and it's maintained by ISC Squared. It was first introduced in 1994, so it's been around for a little while. It's globally recognized and
sorry, just had a little technical issue. I'll restart that.
Vendor neutral, and it's often described as taking a 30,000 foot view of cybersecurity. Don't tune out yet, there are reasons to take the CISSP. Perhaps the biggest reason to take the CISSP exam and become certified is salary. The average CISSP certificate holder earns $131,000 a year in the United States. I've seen statistics anywhere from $128,000 to $154,000. It just really depends on where you work, what sector you work in, what state you work in. Also, your current salary, you can see a bump up as much to 27% of your current salary, which is quite significant. So that's one reason to take the CISSP. Another is job opportunities. Currently in the United States, there are only 95,000 or just over 95,000 CISSP certificate holders, but there are about 140 to 150,000 job openings that are asking for CISSP. It's one of the certificates that is highly requested or desired by employers over other certificates. It also meets the requirements of the ISO, IEC, and several of the DoD certificate requirements. Another reason to take it is to receive credit. At Purdue, you can receive credit for both graduate and undergraduate classes if you get certified in CISSP, or even if you become an associate of CISSP or ISC squared, which we'll talk about what that means in just a second. But there is a list of undergraduate classes you can receive credit for, and recently they trimmed this down, so now there's just one graduate class you receive credit for, which is that Security for Analytics. The CISSP exam covers the 8 domains, and those are on the, listed on the right on the slide. There are two routes to certification. On the left is kind of the more traditional route, where you do 5 years, or you have 5 years of experience in at least 2 of the 8 CISSP domains, and we'll see the domains in just a second. And then after your experience, you pass the exam and you become a member of ISC squared. You get your certificate in CISSP. Becoming a member is $125 a year. You do continuing education. It requires 120 hours of continuing education hours every 3 years, and then you have to follow the code of ethics. Now, the alternate way to do that, or to receive the certificate, is to first pass the exam. And once you pass the exam, you become what is known as an associate of ISC squared. Then you have 6 years to gain 5 years of experience. But what's nice about that is you can use your degree to count as 1 year towards the 5 years, or even a certificate such as CompTIA Security Plus will actually count towards a year. You can either do one or the other, you can't count both. So now you have 6 years to gain 4 years of experience in two of the CISSP domains. Membership for an associate is only $50 a year, and continuing education requires 15 hours every year, and then you have to follow the code of ethics also. The CISSP exam covers the 8 domains, and those are on the, listed on the right on the slide, and those 8 domains is what makes up the common body of knowledge for the CISSP, and it covers pretty much anything in cybersecurity, so it's kind of cybersecurity in a nutshell. The exam itself is 100 to 150 multiple choice questions. Basically, what the algorithm for the test does is at 100 questions, it looks and sees that if you're failing, then it fails you at that point. But if it looks and sees that you're passing, then it passes you at that point. However, if you're kind of in the gray area, then it can add up to another 25 questions to determine pass or failure. Now, even though I just said 100, it can do up to 125, the reason why I have 150 is because they can add an extra 25 questions, which are ungraded, but are ones that they can use for future exams. The test, you have 3 hours to take the test. Don't let that scare you off. I know a lot of people hear 3 hours and they think it kind of sounds scary, but it's not. When I took the test, I had 100 questions, and when I finished, I still had 80 minutes left. So, and I didn't work fast, I just worked steadily through the test, and I still had quite a bit of time left over. So again, don't let the 3 hours throw you. It's a proctored test at a testing center. Currently, you can't take it at home, and the test costs $749. And right now, Purdue doesn't offer any discount, so you have to pay that full price. It's offered in this way, it's offered in 8 languages that are listed there. If you have a language that's not listed on the slide, they do offer tests in other languages, but those tests are then offered on paper. They're 250 questions, and they take 6 hours. So if you can take it in English or one of these languages, that's probably a lot better because it's less time and less questions to have to answer. Here are those 8 domains again that make up the common body of knowledge for the CISSP. And the domains are weighted differently, meaning that their questions have different weights within the test itself. The highest is the security and risk management at 15%. And then here just a couple years ago, they changed the test so that software development security is now up to 11%, whereas before I think it was about 8 or 9%. So they've kind of added some more weight to that one. And then most of the other domains are somewhere around 12 or 13%. So here are some of the resources that I use to study for the CISSP, both on this slide and the following slide. The main source that I used, or the main textbook that I used, was the ISC Squared CISSP Official Study Guide. This edition is actually the newer edition than what we used in the CISSP classes at Purdue. And this was my main book that I studied, that I read through, studied through, answered questions. The book just under that is the official practice test that goes along with that. Both these books are nice because they also have the CYBEX test question bank, which you can access either online or an app on the phone. A lot of the other books that I have on here are just ones that are supplemental that I would use for like discussion boards or essays, or to answer why I answered multiple choice questions a certain way. So there are more ones that I would search, and they're also available in the library. And so I could actually search different topics, and that would help just supplement what I was reading. But most of my study time was spent on the official test guide. And then the 11th hour, the book there at the bottom, I use that near the end. I kind of used it throughout, just looking up topics, but I really read it all the way through just a few weeks before taking the test, because it's kind of the cliff notes. It's a summary of all the things that are on the CISSP. Here are some of the other resources or books that I used. The CISSP for Dummies is nice because it's a little bit more trimmed down than the official study guide. It has some good information. The CCISO and the CISM books there that I also got from the library are really good because they cover more kind of the management side, risk and business plans, disaster recovery plans, and things like that. The Certified Information Systems Security Professional Field Manual, that was really long to say, just the field manual. That book is kind of like the 11th hour that was on the previous slide. It's more of a summary of all the things on the CISSP, and that's another good one to read just near when it's time to take the test, when it's within a couple of weeks of taking the test, just because it summarizes everything that I studied throughout the months leading up to the test. Yeah, we're not robots, so please don't try and read all those books that I have on the resources slides. Just pick one really good study guide, read it all the way through and study it, and then use other things to supplement that knowledge and get some different perspectives. So the important thing about a study schedule is to set the amount of time that you think you need. I've seen where some people have taken anywhere from 3 to 6 months to prepare. When I was preparing for mine, I took about 7 months, and that's just because I did it as I was taking the CISSP 1, 2, and 3 classes at Purdue. I decided that as I was taking those, I would just study a little bit extra, and then I would be able to take the tests after CISSP 3. So you want to also just make sure that you have time to study all the fundamentals and the domains and get a good handle on the 8 domains that we showed earlier. And then do a lot of practice tests and a lot of practice questions. I think that was one of the big things for me, is doing a lot of multiple choice tests every day, taking practice tests that were at least like 200 questions and doing them timed. And by the time that I was ready to take the test, I had taken somewhere around 13,000 multiple choice test questions. So I think that really helps a lot. Then the last 9 weeks is kind of the cram time where I did more questions. And that's when I read the 11th hour and the field manual. And those really helped just to kind of sum up everything that I'd been studying for all those months. So this is the schedule that I had for myself for the last 9 weeks. And because I was still in CISSP 3, I have on there things about reading the chapters and discussion boards and doing a certain amount of CURE questions and CYBEX questions. And just things that would help prepare me, an extra reading to help prepare me so that I'd be ready to take the exam. The nice thing about both CYBEX and LiveSource, where we get our textbooks from for Purdue, is that they also have the option for flashcards. So if you like flashcards, those can be helpful. I do not like flashcards, I learned when I was studying for this, so I kind of just got a big black mark through that line on my little checkoff sheet. My real checkoff sheet is actually really a mess. But this helped me just to prepare and do things every day, so I kind of knew where I was at in preparing for that. And I had a little helpful thing that said, Christy will pass. So, you know, kind of encourage yourself sometimes. Again, I would suggest doing a lot of multiple choice questions just to get used to taking multiple choice questions and also seeing how the information that you're studying, how it's actually asked or put together in multiple choice questions. For me, I used the CURE test engine, which was provided by Purdue during CISSP, and then also the CYBEX from the different study guide and practice test guide that was available. And that was really good to have two different types of test banks, just because they would present the information a little bit different. I also like doing the tests in either learning mode or study mode, because once you answer the question, it would then bring up the answer, the correct answer, and tell you why that was the correct answer. And I found that a lot more effective to study than to wait till the end of the test or the end of the quiz I was taking and then going back through. There's also, if you're not very good at taking multiple choice questions, there's lots of good information online about different tactics or techniques to use to take those questions and practice taking multiple choice questions. I just put a couple down on here that I'd come across. One is to read and ask, which just simply means to read the question without looking at the answers. And one, seeing what they are really asking for, and then seeing if you already know the answer, and then finding that in the options. The other one is to eliminate wrong answers. Just quickly look through and find things that are not correct. And then use clue words and numbers. And clue words can be like best answer, most correct answer, almost, never, always. Those really kind of help, as well as numbers. If there's numbers that don't make any sense in the answers, those probably are not going to be the correct ones. There's also more than one, which is meaning more than one option or answer. And you know, this is when they use all of, none of, A and B, B and C, D and E. And looking at those, and you know that if one's incorrect, you can't do all of the above or none of the above type thing. The other one to look for is sometimes you might have like two answers that are the opposite of each other. And statistically speaking, the likely answer is going to be one of those. You just have to decide which one the answer is going to be. And then the last tip is just to guess. And we know that it's better to guess a question or guess an answer than it is to leave a question blank, just because statistically we have a much better chance of getting it right by answering it.
And then I wanted to provide some example questions, just so that you can see kind of some of the questions that I was asked on the test. These ones are actually ones that I took from Cybex. And so, and if anybody wants to answer, they're more than welcome to jump in and share. So the first question is, Chris is advising travelers from his organization who will be visiting many different countries overseas. He's concerned about the compliance with export control laws. Which of the following technologies is most likely to trigger these regulations? Anybody want to take a stab at it? The answer is encryption software. And another example of questions you'll come across are, which objects and subjects have a label in a mandatory access control model? And no one's being brave to answer. And the answer to this one is all objects and subjects have a label. And those are just a couple examples of the questions that I would have as I was studying for the exam. And then, does anybody have any questions?
This was really great. This was good. And throwing questions at us, it kind of throws us off because I'm terrible at tests, so I can't do them. Although I would have gotten the first one right. I guessed it, and then you gave the answer. I was like, yeah, all right. The second one, I was half right. So, okay.
You were half right. I know. I just saw them there. I was like, oh, I just saw the answers. Whoops, I should have waited a little bit longer to give people time.
That's okay. This was good. It's good to get everybody, you know, into it too. Very nice. Thank you so much. Anybody have any questions for her? All righty. We will go on to our next presenter. Very good, Christy. Very good.
Thank you.
Melanie, are you ready?
I am.
All right, take it on.
So I decided to do my masterclass on DB Schema. Any of you that have heard me talk in Ancient Civilizations meeting or during our soft dev class, soft dev meeting, you've heard me mention DB Schema because I feel like it is an amazing tool for designing and updating a database, because it allows you to create, manage, and visualize your database schemas. So one of the things that DB Schema does, which this is what it is, you can create a layout. And when you create a layout, which it is loading, oh, come on. Okay, so you can create a layout and you can automatically create a table. So when you create the table, you can add a table name test and then add your entities to it. So name, you can add what data type you want to use for it. So I'm just going to keep it as varchar. You can set a maximum length. You can set it as a primary key. You can also set it so if it's not allowed to be null, you can also associate what sequence it is in. So for now, I'm going to put name and I'm going to put in ID and set that as a primary key. So when you do that, you'll have this little option, this little entity come up. And you can add more tables. Let's do a Boolean. So we're going to do a bit and make it not null and put another ID, make it not null, and then test to ID and make that the primary key. So when I add this, now I have an ID here and an ID here that's the primary key. I can actually drag this ID to this and say that is a foreign key, and now I can relate them to each other. So that's just one of the things that you can do with DB Schema. However, I will mention that this is actually part of the paid aspect, which I actually got a license through my work to be able to do the paid. So one of the things that you can do with the free version is you can actually modify and visually see a existing database that you have access to. So you can click on new, connect to the database, and there are tons of options of different types of databases that you can pull from. You can pull from Access, you can pull from MySQL, there's MongoDB, there's Postgres, and obviously there's SQL Server. So I'm going to choose SQL Server because that's what I use most. And when you hit next, you can choose how you log in and choose your database, or you can create a new one. For this example, I'm going to use the database that I created for my Best of Books project, and I'm going to connect to it. You have this option to show only DBO schemas because that is the most widely used. So if you do that, you obviously have all of these options. You can choose just to bring over the tables. You can choose just to bring over the views, stored procedures, etc., and click OK. Once you do that, you'll get this layout. And this basically groups your tables together by what is related. So I have this BOB user table or layout that shows in a group where you have the users that are connected by admin IDs. So you have the admin, which has the foreign key for BOB user ID. And then you have the employee table that also has a foreign key. And then you have the books that has foreign keys for the author ID and the genre ID. And then you can also open your stored procedures and you can modify stored procedures. You can run them. Right now, I don't actually have the information in the table because I already have the available inventory in the table. But if you didn't have the procedure already, you could just create procedure and it will add the procedure to the database in SQL. Another option is you can actually generate a script that will actually generate your entire script for creating the database. So you have the create tables, you have the unique primary keys associated with each table. At the end of this, you also have the foreign keys being added. then you have the stored procedures being added. And all of this, you can actually end up saving as a file, or you can run the script as long as you are connected to the database, and it will create that database for you with all of your stored procedures, all of your foreign keys, and everything. So when you open SQL Server, you will be able to see all of the information when you log in. So when you open up SQL Server, you now have the Best of Books database. You have all of the tables that you had in the DB schema. And then you also have the stored procedures that you added as well. And if you open them, you'll be able to see it is the same information as you had in DB schema. I kind of went through it quickly. So does anyone have any questions while I'm taking a breath? Currently, Dax, I'm actually using Pro Edition because this is what I get from my my work. But the Community Edition has the connection to the database. I did also want to make a note. If you are in this and you make changes, if you are connected to the database, it will make changes to your database. So if you want to make changes to it, but you don't want to make changes to your SQL Server, make sure to push it offline. Anyone else have any questions? All right, Marjorie, I think I'm actually done unless someone else has any other questions.
Well, that was excellent, and I'm totally shocked because I've never seen anything like this, and I think it's awesome.
I love it. I mean, when I first started making databases, I was using Visio to actually create the layouts and how I wanted it. And then I was having to manually add the scripts and all of that to create the database. This just makes it like 20 times easier. All you have to do is do the layout and it does everything for you.
Seriously, it's like, you know, like a gift given to a database person. Right. Like, here, have this instead. Forget Visio. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
This is so much easier. Wow. Well, thank you so much for enlightening us on what we can use now.
Yeah, I would definitely suggest getting the pro version because of the fact that it is so useful. And Charlene, I actually have that information. Give me a moment.
I think everybody's curious. I think everybody wants to have that now. Even if it's just for class, you know, who wants to use Visio anymore?
Well, yeah, I will say that the community version is a lot cheaper. I will say that. Okay, so pro version has so much more. And of course, they don't say it online. Okay. So for educational uses is $98 a year. Personal, it's $196. And then for companies, it's $294. No, so, no. Okay. Dax, I love it.
Yeah, that's it, right? Exactly. Not
it
bad.
Definitely, it is 100% useful. Yes, that is per license, David.
Okay. Cool. Awesome. See, that's why I love Masterclass. Right, guys? I mean, we just learn new things.
I mean, I didn't have like a full presentation and I know I went through it quickly, but I'm so excited using DB Schema because right. I work so much in SQL that it's just amazing. And you
but
can
I can
even
see
do,
why.
Yeah, and you can even do like full databases for NoSQL for it has connections to like I said, MongoDB. I think there was also, I can't remember the AWS one, Cosmo, I think. But all of the NoSQL, all of the relational, like it even has Oracle in there that you can actually generate the creation script for. It's just so amazing.
Well, that's awesome. Yes. Thank you so much for bringing that to us.
No problem.
Anybody have any questions for her? Looks better than DBeaver, huh?
Yes.
Well, you'll have to get it and tell us how it is. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Thank you. Let's see who's next. I have to bring that. Eric. Eric, are you ready?
I am.
Get all this right, started. It's all yours.
Okay. Let's see here. There. All right, do I see it?
Yes.
All right, good deal. So, just to preface what you're about to see, this actually occurred at my place of work about a month. I'm sorry, you're going to hear dogs having a ruckus because they went in here now. But this happened at my place of work about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And it just kind of sent me down a rabbit hole when I was trying to find a topic to talk about. So malicious USB devices. Have you ever found a USB and thought about seeing what's on it? I know we all have curiosity. Or I know me personally, I bring a lightning cable for my phone to work and it disappears 2 days if I leave it on my desk. So word to the wise, don't borrow these items. Don't check it out. And here is why. They'll send them to you. They will send these coming through the mail. This has actually become a thing again. This is an early 2010s method of infection, but it's coming back again in an article. Oh, I believe it. I don't know. I read it somewhere. It was back in 2022. The FBI warned that Fin7, which is a cybercrime group that are behind the Dark Side and Black Matter ransomware operations, are sending these through the mail, just hoping you would plug it into your computer. And we all know what happens when you get ransomware. You know, a couple different choices. You pay, you trash it, or you pray that they just stop. So they will send them to you in the mail. They will leave it for you in the office. This is actually how it occurred at my place of work. We have about 92 separate offices, and the building itself is part of our main complex. A couple of doors were not secured, and an office was left open. The person who resides in that office found this USB device on their desk, and they keep a fairly clean workspace, found a random USB device on their desk, something they don't use. We use a OneDrive sharing system, but this device was left there, and they found it. So they turned it in, and lo and behold, 2 days later, we come back with our tech guys, and they investigated a little bit, found out that it did in fact have a bit of ransomware on it. The other way they'll get you with it is they'll just leave it for you. You know, if you go to Starbucks, people like to write all day long at Starbucks. They leave the USB device behind, and you find one and you say, wow, I got a 256 gig stick. I'm curious what they left on it. I want to see what someone's writing on their manuscript. And that is exactly the way that people, they will get you nowadays. This is a, 15-ish year old type of attack vector, and it is coming back in full force. Curiosity and human nature just take over. So why is this thing not moving when I want it to? Okay. So what can these things do? They will get that you will get cyber attacks. It's outside of the normal the box of, I don't know why I put it like that, but it's outside of the normal box of cyber attacks. They get sent through the mail to companies. Think of it like this. If you get an envelope with a USB device in it, return address from your company, it can be handwritten on very easily, and it comes with a little note, hey, plug this in, check out X, Y, and Z file. Let's call it from accounting or something. You got to check these numbers out. It's imperative that we get this done by Friday, and it's Thursday. A little bit of sense of urgency, and you're just like, man, I really want to check this out, but open it up, and guess what? You see a little blink on the screen. Next thing you know, someone's in your system doing something. Maybe they're just copying everything you're typing in. Maybe they're infecting you with ransomware. Maybe it's just a worm. Heck, maybe it was just a glitch and it's really not a malicious file. Who really knows until the thing's over with. So secondary, you've got a kill USB. These are devices that are set up to send an electrical surge. And I'm going to play a little video for you, and it's just quick 30 seconds. It's going to show you what happens. They put a surge protector in between the USB device and the laptop they were using it on, and then they take the device away. So I'm going to play this. Hopefully you get the sound and everything. Oops. Whoops. Let's hear it. Can you guys hear that sound? So there's the surge. They take it out. They're going to take away the surge protector and plug this device in, and immediately electricals sent through, the power surge sent through the computer. Computer's dead, will not come back on. So pretty heinous little thing to do to somebody, I would say, you know, just to, for nothing more than to create havoc, I would say, I guess is the best way to look at it. So persistent threats, these are the ones that are the most damaging to a corporation. You get that persistent threat in there, and it worms its way through your entire system. You may never get rid of the entire thing. This is when you get into that that segregation. I am sorry about the dog barking. You get into the segregation aspect where you're literally partitioning off parts of your network that will never get rid of this thing, or it'll take too much time and effort that it's not worth the money. So the type of harm these devices can really cause, it's data theft, data damage, data deletion, data encryption. That's when you get into that ransomware type atmosphere. And the hardware related, this is when you get into this kill USB. It's going to be access control of the computer, physical destruction of the computer. That's that kill USB. And monitoring of the user's actions, like a keylogger or just any type of thing where they're capturing anything you're inputting into the computer. It may just be you put a second USB device in, and all of a sudden they have everything that's on it. And then, you know, in a form of like a botnet, you become part of the botnet, and they use your computer resources for crypto mining. Again, just stuff. This is bad news, man. Just you don't want this stuff happening to you. So the types of attacks that originated from me, I just found this to be a pretty interesting little graphic here. The USB hardware is that green box at the top, and then you've got the three types. It's programmable microcontrollers, USB peripherals, and electrical type attacks. And it's just lists different things. If you remember back in 2010, if anybody's ever heard of Kevin Mitnick, he talks about a rubber ducky all the time. And that was one of the very first bad USB devices. He goes in, you know, gains entry, you know, a little social engineering, gains some entry into a bank, plugs this thing in. All of a sudden he has all the bank records. There's documented proof. This is what the guy does for a living. And he uses nothing more than a USB stick and a fake ID badge. Says, hey, I'm here to upgrade your systems. It'd take about 15 minutes, flashes a badge. Somebody says, sure thing, come on in. He plugs it in. Boom, he's got every bit of the bank's information. That's your PII. That's your bank account numbers. That is your just everything that can cause you grief and strife in your life. So the point behind these bad USB devices, I'm sorry, they're not the point, but the sorry, I have a note here. So what they do is they're reprogramming the microcontroller in the actual USB device, whether it be a USB stick or USB peripheral. And it basically impersonates a keyboard and sends malicious commands to the computer to which it's attacked, which in a slide or two here, I'm going to show you a quick 2-minute video of a guy, of Kevin Mitnick, actually attacking through a lightning cable, which is one of the cooler things I've seen in a bit. You'll get an idea of how small these things can get, because if you have an iPhone, you understand how small these controllers are on your, or the peripherals are on your iPhone. And you would think it doesn't have enough space to do this. It does. So do you just avoid the USB drives? That's where we're getting another peripheral here. How many times have you borrowed that friend's charger for a quick, you know, give your phone a quick jump? Scary fact that anything can be, that utilizes USB, I don't know why I said a USB cable, but anything that utilizes USB can be used to hack you. This began as an NSA spy tool. It was an exorbitant cost. Now you can purchase these things for literal pennies on the dollar. I did a quick Google search and found that one at the top picture there, $75. $75 is expensive for a USB cable, but for the amount of information and the value that it would hold to an ethical hacker, and this is well worth the money. The little black ring right there is actually the charger and the activator for it. So that's what initiates the attack. You leave it somewhere, someone uses it. They never even have a clue that they used a bad device. So what does it do? In this case, again, it eavesdrops, it's key logs, it tracks your GPS. That's frightening that they will know where you're at all times once you plug this in one time. Or in a worst case scenario, it takes control of your device, all from that little charging cable. How do you avoid these scary little things? First and foremost, if you didn't buy it, don't use it. Make sure you keep your antivirus updated. No one trusts anyone who you're going to borrow one from. And I mean, I guess do your background and make sure they bought it themselves, that it's their personal item. They didn't find it somewhere. And just, I guess the most important thing, don't take anything for granted. If you think it's safe, there's a high likelihood it will be, but I don't know. I guess I'm just a little bit paranoid about these kind of things now after watching this simple little video right here. Sorry, it's getting small. But this is actually a pretty cool demonstration of what this USB cable right above it does.
Hi, I'm Kevin Mitnick, Nova Force Chief Hacking Officer, and I have something super exciting to show you, and you need to be aware of this new vector of attack. Back in 2014, a good friend and brilliant security researcher, Karsten Knoll, released what we know as the bad USB attack. In fact, Karsten gave me the original bad USB 4 years ago. And how this attack worked is the victim would plug this into their computer, and it would become an HID device, which is a keyboard. And then this device would actually inject keystrokes onto the system, and it could do things like download malware and that sort of thing. And this has been around for 4 years, so it's kind of dated.
Oh, what happened?
But security researchers have exploited Karsten's work to do
cool things.
And what are those things? It's, for example, weaponizing a computer mouse that uses a USB with the same technology to inject keystrokes. And most recently, and this is a little bit scary, they've done it simply with a cable. So here we have a micro USB cable. I actually have two others. I have a Lightning cable, I have a USB-C, the USB-C cable, and it does exactly the same thing. So when the victim simply plugs in the cable to charge a device, it actually does the same thing that the bad USB does, injects keystrokes, and takes over their computer. So let me show you how that works. So let me show you how this cable attack actually works. A friend of mine, Olaf, in Shenzhen, China, actually designed this new cable. And this looks indistinguishable from an ordinary micro USB cable. So what we're going to do is take a look over here. We have a Windows 10 laptop with the latest security updates and antivirus definitions. Over here on the right, we have the attacker computer, and we're connected to a remote access Trojan listener in the cloud. So let's go ahead and plug in the cable. And by the way, weaponize this to immediately inject the keystrokes. Ordinarily, we triggered on some other event. So let me go ahead and plug it in. Plug in the cable. Let's watch the screen for a moment. Here we go. The keystrokes are being injected by the cable, or by the technology in the cable. And there we go, it's injected. And over here on the right, we should see the Trojan connect, and here it is. So what that means is the attacker has full control of this laptop because the cable actually infected it. And this cable actually works. So if we plug in a hotspot to charge, the green light will come on showing that it's actually charging. So the cable actually works. So this is kind of scary because now your enterprise could be affected simply by a malicious cable.
All right. So that in and of itself, just frighten you. Keeping your stuff together. Come on. There we go. Keeping your stuff as your stuff, man, it is just imperative that you, well, I guess, how do you survive? You don't trust anyone, right? I mean, that's really the way to go, is keep your policies up to date. If your company doesn't need USB, if you're working mainly out of the cloud, out of OneDrive, you don't have a reason to need a USB stick on a computer. You don't have a reason to need those ports turned on. Turn them off. Block them. Don't let them do any work. keep a tidy work area. So this is one of the things that I plugged this in, never found it anywhere. But one of the reasons that our employee who found the malicious device a couple of months ago noticed is because it was left on a workspace that is normally 100% clear, just left in the middle of the desk, like she left it there. And thank goodness that, you know, she reads our memos and she reads the different snippets that our tech team puts out about weekly. So, and again, utilize the shared workspace, Google Drive, Microsoft OneDrive, other enterprise collaboration systems through the cloud, and avoid the need for these devices altogether. I have worked in an environment before that just flat out banned them. If they see you with something plugged into your computer, it could lead up to immediate termination. So they took their security pretty seriously, in my opinion. So how do you protect your company? Keep your policies and practices up to date. Make sure that your acceptable use stuff, needed, unneeded ports, things like that, all the stuff that we talk about constantly in cybersecurity, make sure they're doing it. If your practices are lacking, you're going to get attacked. You know, I saw on somebody, it may have been on one of our previous masterclasses, but former FBI head said there's only two types of companies in the world, those that have been hacked and those that are going to get hacked. It's going to happen. So the best thing we can do is to take as many different avenues away to allow that to happen to our company. So secondary is educate. PEBCAC, I love this. I love this anagram this terminology is problem exists between chair and keyboard. It's a widely held sentiment that the weakest link in any security situation is the human element. And it's our job, on top of protecting them, to teach and educate, engage in ongoing training, to do the right thing and be the role models for our company. Tech is boring to a lot of people. They, as long as Facebook works, they don't care how it works. They don't care what keeps them safe. They just care that it works. So it's our job to keep them up to date on those things and then keep the awareness high. In my company's case, again, we were lucky that employee found the device. She'd read the memos. We were just blatantly lucky. And now the new memo is make sure you close and lock your door. But at the end of the day, we were lucky that she read those things and noticed something out of the ordinary. Keep reiterating what's been taught, and only through the reinforcement are you going to get people on board with it. I feel like I walked into a good situation, and we've just managed to keep a really good culture. I feel like it's very high engagement, and as long as you have that engagement between departments and between people inside your organization, you're always going to have that awareness level. And finally, does anyone have any questions? I try to keep that right at the 15-minute mark.
Well, thank you for opening our eyes on that one. My goodness.
Like I said, it's an old attack. I mean, this 13-year-old attack was the first one, and you know, they're back in full force with, you know, blatant ransomware now. So,
of course.
But well, if anybody's got any questions, throw them out there. If not, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you so much. That was excellent. Lots of information tonight. Thank you. All right, Carla.
Yes, hello.
Are you ready?
I am ready. Okay, let's see. Now I gotta ask the obligatory, can everybody see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Sounds good. All right, then. Hello, everybody. I don't think I may be the last presenter here tonight. And if that's the case, then good evening to everybody. I will be discussing UI and UX web design today. If you're a full stack developer like myself, then this may be something that hasn't been at the front of your mind, where most of the time we're worried about the back end and algorithms and things of that nature. So I'm hoping to shed a little bit of light with what I've learned these past couple of weeks here in the internship that I've had. So the first thing is, why is it important? And well, the front end of your website is going to be the very first thing that people see when they come to visit you. So depending on what your project is or what your business is, whatever your goal of the website is, they are going to be judging it based on what it looks like and how they're able to interact with it. Is it something that they can follow along easily? Can they get to where they need to go? Is your design deliberate enough that you're able to achieve what you set out to do with the website in the first place? So you want to be thinking, what is the main purpose of my website the whole way through from start to finish, right? So even though you also have to think about the logic for the code and how it's going to get created at all, you do want to keep the design in mind as well. So for this presentation, we're going to divide that up into three key concepts, which is going to be the branding, behavioral patterns, and ethic responsibility. So the first part is the branding, which is all about who you are or what your website's for. The first thing most people think of is a logo when they think of branding, which makes perfect sense. You know, I think of Coca-Cola and I think about that font. I think about, I can't even think of anything else. Mickey Mouse, I guess. You think of the iconic ear shapes, right? But branding can actually be a lot more than that, because it's going to be all about your colors, the feelings, and the overall presentation of what you are trying to brand yourself as. So, for example, though it's not super well known, there are a lot of companies that do go out of their way to actually copyright the colors that they use. So if you want to use the same exact shade that Target uses, you actually have to be really careful about how you incorporate that, because you may be infringing on their copyright of that red shade. The same thing goes for the magenta that T-Mobile uses and other companies like that. And the reason why they invest so much into it is because they incorporate it into part of their identity. So if not just your logo, then keep in mind the feelings of what you're trying to convey with your website, the theme, and the colors. And we can get a little bit more here with this example. This is actually a template from one of the WordPress themes that's just readily available out of the package. And this one is supposed to be specifically for a company that worries about creating organic foods and vegetables ready to order. So you can actually customize the vegetables that go into your box. And immediately you can tell by the darker shade of colors while still being bright and colorful that they're going for something that is very fresh, very cool, relaxing, so that you can get into that feeling of, yeah, I would love to be sitting in my little cottage eating some delicious veggies that came right from my garden, or things along that line. And they incorporate that in there with their colors and the theme. All right, so moving on from the branding, we come to the behavioral patterns, which is where most of the research into user experience gets invested into. No two people are ever going to be exactly the same, but you are going to always have some similarities. So even though these researchers have been able to find a lot of correlating results in their different experiments that they've run, you know, not everyone's going to have the same experience. However, with that research, we can actually try and control the way that people will engage with your website. You just have to be mindful of it and be able to apply it. So let's get into another example about that here. So most people, at least in the Western world, with more of the user experience research hasn't taken place, will start reading from left to right. So your eyes are going to start at the top and then go to the left. And then they may go diagonally down here. You continue on to the left. And you would continue in that pattern until you get to the bottom of the page. Or you may scroll down and then continue that pattern on forward. This is the most common pattern that people will follow when they go into your website. So knowing that, you can then arrange your website in a layout that will be more beneficial to you. So you may start with the navigation panel at the top, where they may be able to see it clearly. And then at the end of that first left area there, you may put the login button where people will expect it, because that will be the call to action they can follow. After that, they'll go back down to the left-hand side again. And then you can put some content that they can read. To the right, you can put a contact form where they can engage. And then you would continue that pattern along the way. Although this is the most common one, it's not the only one. This one does allow for some follow area here. And what a follow area is basically dead space, more or less. Most people are not going to linger there too long. They're actually going to move on pretty quickly onto the next thing. And so most of the time, these areas are either avoided, or nowadays you'll see things in there like the login button or just really standard stuff that you don't expect people to really engage with too much. Everything else is going to be in the center. Another common pattern is going to be something more similar to an F formation that goes from the very top of the page all the way down, and then left to right, left to right, left to right without going diagonally. Even though these patterns exist, you can disrupt them pretty easily with the way that you design your page. So if you wanted to have something where, okay, I know people are going to start here on the left-hand side and then continue on this little zigzag that they normally go on. But I really want to make sure that they're seeing my options here. So maybe I can put my contact page here on the left instead of on the right, because I want them to know what the contact information is before they can get to what the services are that I'm offering. So depending on what you're going for or what the purpose of your web page is, this is how you can start taking advantage of understanding these patterns. This is just one of the many that exist. All right, so moving on from that, we can get into the ethical considerations that you need to keep in mind when you're designing your web page. The first of them is going to be accessibility, which seems pretty obvious. Everyone's life experience is different. Not everyone's going to be able to engage with your website the same exact way. You're going to need to have alt methods of text in there that people who may not be able to see or are legally blind will be able to still navigate your web page and be able to get to the content that is the main reason why they're on your web page, right? Beyond that, you want to consider liability. What are you responsible for having this website? How can you make sure that you avoid legal problems or any severe consequences for not complying with what is standard? And then your identity, because as always, your front end is going to be how you present yourself to the world. So however you decide to incorporate what you've learned with the patterns and everything else, that's going to tell and communicate to people, this is really what I'm all about. And for us to really better understand that, I have one last example. Oh, but before that, these are all of the different regulations you have to keep in mind when you're creating web pages. A lot of these are, you know, pretty straightforward. You know, you need to have your terms and conditions, your disclaimers, always keep in mind about plagiarism and copyright. But some of the other ones may not be super obvious. For example, if you're working with healthcare, you're gonna have to deal with HIPAA on your webpage. So, you know, be really careful. Do you really wanna have testimonials on your webpage? Is that legally allowed? Take that into careful consideration before you incorporate any of that into your web page. The ADA is very important. I think we've had a master class about that as well. Make sure that your web page follows all of the accessibility standards that have been set out for people, and the general data protection as well. You know, it's all part of the same thing, and that's all in the front end side. Some US states even require contractors to display their identity mark as well. So for example, you may always be seeing the WordPress powered or GoDaddy powered for anything that was developed by them specifically. And that's a part of one of those legal restrictions to keep in mind. If it's not available there, then you may be violating state law. So that is something to always keep in mind as well. Now onto that example I promised you. So here we have a very hastily created on PowerPoint web page here to show you what a bad example would look like. So not only is it a little difficult to follow, it is also purposely hiding the disclaimer with the contrast and is also not ADA compliant. And what this kind of shows you in this like extreme example of it is that this may be not necessarily truthful. It's probably a scam of some kind. It's communicating to me that I can't really trust this product. They're not being honest. They're not really telling me what's in there. I can't even navigate to an about page to learn about what their product even has in it or anything of that nature. So this is a severe example, but you can kind of start to imagine and kind of connect the dots about okay, this is what I would change if I could, and go in and make sure that everything is up to standard. Not only that, but then also follows a specific set of branding. So the colors everywhere, it doesn't make sense. And this could use a lot of workshopping. So we can infer from that that we need to really go and fix that up. But that is the general quick and short SparkNotes version of UI UX design for web pages specifically. It gets a lot different when you start working with things like programs or video games and things of that nature. But the general gist is always going to be the same. It's always going to be about making sure that you are accessible, you're clear with what your goal is, and that you represent yourself and your project in a way that is, you know, really representative of what you're there for. So you don't want to give people the impression that you just did something to make money real quick and you don't really care if they're able to get to where they need to go. If you're designing an educational course for people with low computer skills or computer literacy, then you need to be really careful about how you're linking your content or leaving your breadcrumbs so that people can get to the pages they need. But that is the general gist of it. So if anyone has any questions, I'll take some now.
Great job explaining that, definitely. So for the page before that you had where there was errors on it or really didn't look the way it would, what were the changes that, what changes would you make to it?
Yeah. So for example, here at the bottom, it may be really difficult to see it because this is, I made it as extreme as I could. The contrast is not great, so you cannot see that disclaimer message very clearly. In a real world scenario, there have been some credit unions that have hidden their disclaimers or legal terms and conditions in a similar way by making the contracts really difficult to read. And then the way that they created their pattern specifically, so you're reading, you're going through your zigzag, and then you see this buy now button. Very clear, very bright. It draws your attention there. You're not necessarily looking at that footer with the disclaimer that's saying something about, hey, you know, our services seem really cool, but actually we have these other problems that you may need to take into consideration. They're hiding it on purpose so that they can get more business. I wasn't sure if I was legally allowed to put that in my PowerPoint, so I just didn't because I didn't want, you know, anything about defamation or anything like that. But that would be one of the changes there. Another thing for the real reviews part, it would be a good idea if it's not specifically related to healthcare and it's just about beauty products and things of that nature, you could definitely have like the people's names, what their reviews were, and you know, you may want to mix them up a little bit too, not have the just positives, maybe have a little bit of people who are like, eh, it's okay. Because that can build confidence too and trust in your project. And it shows that you have care in what people are saying. You respond to feedback positively. So that would send a positive message. And that could be a way to increase your branding and go on, so and so forth.
Excellent. I say the same thing. Great job. That was really cool to watch that and to see the differences and to see how it's really built out that way. Great. I think everybody did a great job. Does anybody have any questions for anybody that has presented tonight that you might have thought up at this point? Nope, I agree with Charlene. Good job, everybody. Absolutely. You did great. A round of applause from everybody. Yep, I think you did great. And really appreciate everything you came up with, you guys. You did a great job. And congratulations. And I guess we can go. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks. Good night.